Welcome to the Hump Day Podcast. My name is Pastor Kevin Robertson. It is February 15th, the day after Valentine's. So hopefully if you had a Valentine's, you treated your wife right or you treated your other half right. But we're finished with Valentine's. I have the privilege, and I mean privilege, to interview Dennis Neal. Now, the reason I love Dennis Neal is because I'm a friend on Facebook with him. And he's very colorful. You have no idea what he's going to say. You know how he feels. Am I right?
You're right.
You're right?
You're right.
And he has no problems with unfriending people.
No, I don't.
So if you're still his friend, you're still good with him.
That's right.
And so he makes that important. So if you're listening to this because you're one of his Facebook friends, I'm so fascinated with Dennis because I read his posts and I read and I have one-on-one conversations, and I would say you feel passionate about what you believe.
I do.
Okay.
That's life. If you're not living life passionately, you're not living. You're just existing.
That's true. So I'm going to try to get in your head
today. Okay.
And what
okay.
Okay. And what I'm going to do is tell us about your upbringing. Tell us where you were, about your family and children, your family, how you were brought up.
Okay.
Like that.
Okay. I was born in 1948.
Okay.
Okay, and that's very important. I'm a baby boomer.
All right.
And my parents met during the war, World War II. And I was born in New York City. I was born in Women's Hospital, which is now gone.
Okay.
And I was named Dennis after a B-movie star named Dennis Morgan.
Really?
Yeah. My folks raised me in a housing development in Harlem called the Riverton Housing Development, of which I am very proud to be a part of that. We are having a reunion in July marking the 70th year of the Riverton, which has produced such luminaries as David Dinkins, the former mayor of New York.
Really?
Suzanne DePass, former president of Motown.
Uh-huh.
Clifford Alexander Jr., who was the first black secretary of the army. Robert Mangum, who was the youngest deputy police commissioner of New York. There is an array of talent, you know,
coming out of
the Riverton, okay. And it was a community that uplifted everyone that was in there.
So you had a positive experience.
I had a most positive experience there.
Okay, in that community.
In that community.
So you're implying like when I got outside of the
community. Yeah, that's a different deal. The Riverton was built by Metropolitan Life Insurance, who also owned Stuyvesant Town in New York.
Okay.
But they would not let blacks and Jews live there. So they went ahead, Metropolitan,
really?
And they went ahead and they built Parkchester in the Bronx, okay. And they built the Riverton in Harlem.
Okay.
The Riverton was built across from a coal yard and a sanitation building. Okay. And my question now with some of my peers is, why did so many of us get cancer? But that's for another topic.
Okay. Good point.
So anyway, I'm light complexioned as a black. And at the time, even though I'm bald now, I had hair, curly hair. And when I left the Riverton, I was subject to a lot of stuff. I also went to a Catholic school up the street, and they didn't like the kids from the Riverton, people that lived outside of Riverton.
Okay.
And if you didn't fight and if you couldn't run, you got your butt whipped.
Okay.
I chose to run for a minute. My father made sure that I became a fighter. And once I started fighting, people stopped messing with me. And I'm going to leave it at that,
okay.
That part of it.
Okay.
I went to a local Catholic school where all the students were black and the nuns were white. The parish priest, Father White, was white.
Okay.
I was, like, really into Catholicism.
Oh.
My parents transferred me to another school in the seventh grade, which was all boys. It was 95% white, and it was male Irish Christian Brother teachers.
Oh, wow.
They whipped... But And they particularly whipped my butt because I had a smart mouth. I was new. I had one teacher tell me, I don't like you.
Just flat out told me.
So, yeah. You know, my getaway was I played ball. I played basketball.
Did you experience, when you went to old boys' school, was that your really first true experience of racism?
No, because growing up, my mother was from South Carolina, Anderson, South Carolina, which is near Greenville. Every summer, for as long as I could remember, up until I was about 13, I went south within days of school ending for the summer. I had encounters as a 10 or 11-year-old. I remember separate waiting areas in the railroad stations, the bus stations, the water fountains, white and colored. I remember that I wanted to go to mass, church mass, and my aunt took me to the church, and they would not let me come into church because it was a white Catholic church.
Really?
They sent me to another church, and that was when I started thinking, like, something's not right here. It was at that point.
But you didn't say, it was, you weren't thinking of it was racist.
Oh, no. And my aunt and my mother made it real clear to me, that's racism. That this is what we deal with. And they would tell me it was worse for them growing up in the 20s and 30s.
Do you remember what decade this was?
This was in the 50s.
Okay, in the 50s.
Yeah.
So,
you know, early 50s, like probably I was about 8, so it's probably about 56.
So to me, it's like I read about this in history, but I've never experienced it.
It's funny when we talk about history, you know, people have a way of, as we're finding out currently, of shape-shifting history, of you know, doing little things to color it, to nuance it in different directions. I remember seeing this, you know. I remember my mother, when I was 10 years old, in the original Bloomingdale's in New York, being online and having a white woman step in front of her, and my mother said something, and the woman called her out of her name, and my mother slapped the doo-doo out of her.
Oh, really?
I was stunned as a 10-year-old that my mother would do this. Yeah. But I got it. She grew up in the South. She wasn't having it.
Yeah.
And my aunt, her sister, was even worse. She was an assistant principal at a junior high school in New York. And, you know, she put the fear of the Lord in some of those administrators for their treatment of the black and Latino kids in her school.
Oh, absolutely. So you, when you grew up in the Catholic church, or not grew up, but you went to school in the
Catholic. Yeah, I went to Catholic school.
Did you have a sense of calling in there, or was it anti-Catholic?
No, I was, you know, I, in the, like, 10th grade, entertained the thought that I may be getting called to the priesthood.
Okay.
And I talked about it, and, you know, I made plans to, like, spend a year in a seminary.
Do you think they were supportive of the teachers?
They were supportive yet skeptical.
Okay.
Because I wasn't I wasn't like a typical, like, pious kind of kid. I was robust, you know.
And you question a lot.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
That's one thing I've noticed.
You know, and they, you know, I eventually got to the point where I realized this is not what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
You know, and, you know, at that point in my life, I tried to get into West Point. Adam Clayton Powell was my congressman. Okay. He arranged for me to take the test. Mm-hmm. I did well on the tests, but I have a slight case of scoliosis, very slight, and that kept me out of proceeding any further. It also kept me off of two police departments.
Okay, so you wanted to be a cop?
I tried to get on the police department in New York only because I didn't know what else I wanted to do.
So it's just sounded.
I lived out here in 1974, and I tried to get on the police department out here, and because of a DUI and scoliosis, that wasn't going to happen. And that, to me, was God saying, nah, Dennis, nah, I got something else for you.
Okay. So in your life after high school and then finished, when did you get the eye for acting?
I did plays as a kid, you know, and it was something that I really liked. Mm. And growing up, I fabricated stories.
Okay.
I'm not talking about lies. Right, I'm talking... Right. I made up stories.
You're not talking about alternative facts?
Yeah, not alternative facts. Yeah, I'm talking about, you know, I made up stories for myself, my own entertainment. Right. I colored, I drew, I did all of that. And I thought about it, mm-hmm. and I didn't think about it anymore until I was an adult. Okay. And by the time I started acting, I was 38. I had gotten sober.
Well, let's unpack that.
Oh, let's unpack. Woo, let's go back.
Yeah, let's unpack. Because the thing is, everyone has these incredible stories.
We have moments.
Yeah, the moments.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are struggling with addictions now. And when you're 38 years old, we're talking about decades ago.
Yeah,
So tell us how that happened, where you started. It's not just alcohol.
No. I was a junkyard dog.
Okay,
that's what I was.
Okay, I want to say it in a nice way.
Okay, well that is a nice way.
The junkyard dog.
I'm a junkyard dog.
At your worst, where were you? What were you?
Okay, at my worst.
Yeah, what did that look like?
God, Kevin. You know, bottoms are different for different people, and you can have different bottoms until you really hit the bottom.
Right. Or the bottom for you then.
At that moment.
Yeah.
I hit a number of bottoms.
Okay.
But I always came back for more. I wasn't ready to quit. I got up off that bottom. And I went back to drinking, I went back to drugging, I went back to all of this. So there were various bottoms. The bottom came in 1987, February 28th.
Okay.
I drank a half a gallon of rum and I took 20 Demerols and Percodan.
Oh, good night. That should have killed you.
That was the whole point. It was not by, you know, being social. Made a conscious decision that I did not want to deal with this anymore. And by this, I meant my life and what I had done with it to this point.
Okay.
I had destroyed relationships. I had thrown jobs out the window. I had moved and relocated.
Right.
I had started a new relationship. I had messed that up. I was just sick and tired of me and what I was doing to people.
So you constantly said, it's not worth it.
I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be here anymore.
And basically you said...
I'm done. I don't want to be here anymore. It's not basically. Okay. I said I don't want to be here anymore.
So...
Now, you want to know what happened then?
Yeah, I was kind of curious because... Yeah. I mean, not...
And now, some people don't believe this.
Okay.
And I could care less.
Okay.
I believe in near-death experiences. And I had one. And I talked to my father, who had been dead since 1977. I was talking to him during this moment.
Oh, wow.
The way you and I are talking right now.
Okay.
And he made it very clear to me that I was not done here, and I had to go back and straighten up some things, learn some things, teach some things, become some things, and I didn't want to. And I was very angry when I came to, and I found that I was still here.
So during that period, your dad was speaking to you.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, I didn't sit with God. Right. I didn't sit with Jesus. Right. I wasn't with an angel. I was conversing with my father,
right.
William Neal,
okay.
as clearly as you and I are conversing right now.
Wow! And how long?
A moment. In that space, there is no time. It's a moment.
Yeah.
You know, I know I was brought into the hospital. I was told that I got up off the emergency room table and walked down the hallway in my gown with the IV in me. I was told all of this. I was told that they had to defibrillate me, and I saw that, and I believe it, and I got sober. I came to, and I went into treatment, and I went to AA in Florida. I'd left New York, going to Florida, and a bunch of Southern white alcoholics and drug addicts loved me back to life.
Wow.
And it is the second best thing that has ever happened
for me. So that was where you developed hope, I would assume?
No, no hope.
Okay.
I don't believe in hope.
Okay.
I really don't believe in hope. I have no frame of reference to embrace hope. I believe in faith, and I believe in that what is. I accept acceptance, and I learned that in AA. Right. Acceptance for me is acknowledging that what is, and then dealing with it.
Okay.
And good and bad, I don't really know good and bad. You want to talk to me about evil, I can tell you about evil, but you know, good and bad to me, you know, was it good I got married the first time and bad I got divorced, or was it bad I got married the first time and good I got divorced?
Yeah.
I can't make those judgments because I have a 48-year-old son as a result of it that I love dearly.
Yeah.
And I have three grandsons and a granddaughter as a result of it that I love dearly. So, you know, good and bad, but the other stuff,
yeah, I get okay. So now let's go back to when you were 38. Because I wanted to go in that. I just think that was a critical story.
Okay.
So moving on, when you 38 was really...
That was a big year for me. I got sober, and I said in an AA meeting, you know, I've always wanted to be an actor.
Right, okay.
In an AA meeting, and there was a woman in there that was a photographer, and she said, I'll take your headshot.
Okay.
There was a kid in there that was working as a production assistant on the Disney movie Splash 2.
Oh, really?
And he said, do you want to work as an extra tomorrow? Uh-huh. And I did. And I met an agent, and the agent signed me, and I went to an audition, my first audition, and I booked a part on the new Leave It to Beaver. And I was a detective looking for Eddie Haskell.
Oh, really?
Yes, that was my first professional acting job. Too,
the second one.
Yep.
Well,
with
cool.
all of them grown up with their kids. So, you know.
Oh, that's cool. I had no idea.
You never knew that.
No,
did
I never
you?
Knew
it. Neither did my friends in New York. When I left New York, like, strung out, 138 pounds.
Right.
They thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
But my mother and my stepfather got me back on my feet in spite of myself. And when folks saw me on TV, it was like, I can't believe this.
Dennis, is that
Dennis? Dennis? Yeah.
That can't be Dennis. Yeah. There's no way.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, you've been very successful in not only acting on TV, but also movies and plays, too.
Yeah, I'm so under the radar.
Right.
But, you know, there are people that I've worked with, and they really respect what I do, and I pay attention, and I'm not concerned with being that guy, being a celebrity.
Right.
I like just doing what I do and teaching acting, and I love doing plays. I started co-founded a theater company in Orlando called Mad Cow, which is celebrating 20 years.
Right.
And I had an opportunity to world premiere a play by Terry Teachout. He's the Wall Street Journal theater critic. I had an opportunity to do a one-man show with Louis Armstrong and his manager, Joe Glazer.
Right.
I get to work with fabulous people.
And the thing is, if you show the picture, because I saw the headshot, you looked exactly like Louis Armstrong.
And I don't know how that happened, because I don't look anything like him. He's, you know, a darker complexion. He's shorter. I don't look anything like Joe Glazer, either, who was a 6-foot, 1-inch Jewish guy out of Chicago. But I pulled it off, and I had people saying, you know. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently, the play has been performed by other actors,
right.
And it did amazingly well.
Yeah.
But I can say, in the printed version of the book, Satchmo at the Waldorf, the play, I'm the first one to do it.
Wow.
And that means something to me.
And the thing is, if you listen to the podcast, you gave me a DVD years ago, and you were playing someone at the post office.
Oh, yeah, Letters to God.
Letters to God.
Right.
Which, if you haven't seen the Letters to God, it was so interesting. It's such a powerful movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie, very good movie.
And it's very spiritual. And then when I'm watching it, it has a spiritual depth to it. And then I'm going, I'm seeing Dennis in the movie, too. So it's like, okay, I'm struggling with this.
You know, it was weird, too. When we were shooting that movie, I was also doing a play.
Mm-hmm.
Called The Last Days of Judas Iscariot. And it was a play about the trial of Judas.
Okay.
And I was playing Satan in the play. So in the movie by day, I'm bringing this other guy closer to God.
Yeah.
And in the evening during the play, I'm confronting people with some really raw truths as that other angel.
Right.
And I got a lot out of that, too.
Yeah.
I got to grow out of that.
Well, it's almost like a spiritual depth doing both sides and having that understanding.
Yeah.
So you're moving on in acting and stuff like that, but the personal life is just not going as well as you thought it would go.
Well, at that time, my personal life was a mess. You know, and that's my fault.
Yeah.
I have never been able to blame anyone else for what I do and what happens to me. I just haven't been able to do it.
Yeah.
And I've taken some hits, but my behavior at various times has been, you know, like suspect.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I haven't been, you know, a murderer or, you know, you didn't have to worry about me breaking into your house at night. But I was looking out for Dennis.
Right.
And you know, if I could avoid any conflict, I would. But if I couldn't, well, let's have some conflict.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And getting sober, I realized climbing out of that hole I had put myself in, I was going to be conscious of all of the wreckage and debris I had caused, and I was going to have to rectify a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And to the best of my ability,
right.
in the past almost 30 years, I've done that. You know, there are still one or two people that don't want to deal with me, and I'm okay with that because, in truth, I really don't want to deal with them either. You know, I was building myself up to get in a position to be here.
Right.
You know, to be in this moment.
Right.
So,
now one thing that you and I have in common. And I would think we have in common is we're both mama's boys.
Yeah.
And so tell us about your relationship with your mother, because one thing that I've learned from you, you're just a few years ahead of me. And so because my mother has stage 7 dementia.
Right.
And I'm going through emotions of, and then there's times I can talk to you, and you just look at me, and I go, he gets it. And so tell us about your relationship with your mom.
Okay, well, I'm writing a show.
Okay.
And the name of the show is Pop's Son, Mama's Boy.
Okay.
That's the name of my show.
All right. Pop's Son, Mama's Boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
My father died suddenly at 55 from a massive coronary.
Right.
He was, without a doubt, my best friend.
Okay, your dad.
Yes, and I grieved him for years and years and years. I did a lot of drinking because of that,
right.
too. But you asked me about my mother. My mother always wanted to be my best friend, but she was my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a great mommy when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
She was a wonderful mom when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
She was a difficult mother when I was a young man.
Mm.
She was my favorite person in the world during the last days.
Mm.
I had the privilege of fighting my mother on all kinds of levels because She did her best to make me my best, yeah. as did my father. We did not get along for most of my adult life. Yeah. But when she, when my stepdad passed, we found out my mother had dementia. Mm-hmm. And as it progressed, I was living out here in Los Angeles then, and I made a decision to go back to Florida. That ended my last marriage. Mm-hmm. It put a real crimp in what was becoming a pretty good career out here. Mm-hmm. But it was a no-brainer. I'm going back to Florida. I'm going to take care of my mother. And I did that for 4 years. Yeah. My sister and I looked out for her, and I remember the one evening we were watching a show on TV. I think it was Wheel of Fortune or Jeopardy. Mm. We were sitting on the sofa, and she just turned and looked at me, and my mother's name was Evelyn. Mm. And she said, "Evelyn's not here anymore, and nobody can find her."
Wow.
And I was done, because mm-hmm. I knew my mother was gone then. Yeah. So it was another 2 years or so in the house, and then she would tell me, she said, "I'm not going to ever let you bathe me. Mm. You're not going to be wiping me. Yeah. You're not going to do that." Yeah. And she would fight my sister doing it, but it became... It became too much, mm-hmm. and we put her in a facility, and she lived about two and a half more years, and then she passed away. And I remember, you know, I'd go in and reintroduce myself to her. "Hi, my name is Dennis." And she'd say, "I have a little boy named Dennis."
Yeah.
So, you know, I got it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I... understand really mm-hmm. what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And my heart goes out to you. But this is yours to deal with.
Absolutely.
And it's going to make you a better person. And I would suggest that you find some humor in it too, because yeah. my mother and I did find the funny.
Yeah.
It was not for a long period of time.
Right.
But we found the funny, and that was for my sanity as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, and we have something else in common. Well, a couple of things.
We do have.
I have, what do I have, Kevin? You're looking at.
You have a tremor. He's holding his hand and he's shaking.
That's right.
Which I have a tremor.
Yes. And what's your birthday?
It's September 5th.
And what's my birthday?
September 5th.
So there you go.
I was born in 1962.
Yep, and I wasn't. I'm 14 or 15 years older than you.
But here's the cool thing, too. When you're going through this stuff, because this is where we kind of connected in a way before we even connected, if that makes sense. I was sitting in this office with Sulis that we began praying that she would meet a husband that she would feel safe with, not knowing it was you, because Sulis never been married, did a beautiful job raising her son.
Mm-hmm.
He's in college now.
He's out of college, and he is getting ready to accept his job. Well, he's accepted it, and he's going to work for Nike, and he's moving to Beaverton, Oregon.
That is crazy.
And that was his heart's desire.
Yeah. So she did not raise a dummy.
No, she did
not. She did an incredible job.
Yes, she did.
Raising this. I mean, it's a miracle.
Yep.
It's just a miracle. But anyway, kudos to her. But anyway, she just was hurting in relationship. So how in the world did you guys meet?
Okay. I had just finished doing the play as Louis Armstrong.
Okay.
In Florida. Mm. My partner and I had the rights to do it in Chicago and New Orleans. I came out here for a 2-week rest, and then my plan was to go back to Florida. We were going to restage the play. So I get out here on a Wednesday. I'm staying with my friend Nina. She says, I've got somebody I want you to meet. Mm-hmm. I told her I don't want to meet any more of your friends. This is a dance we'd been doing on and off for years.
Okay.
She said, well, they're coming over Friday anyway. Mm-hmm. Friday, some people came over to her apartment, and the last person to come in was Susan.
Okay.
And I hugged her, and I took a really deep embrace, mm-hmm. because something felt weird.
Yeah.
I sat down. She came and sat next to me. We started talking. And I didn't see her the next day, which was Saturday. I saw her the day after and every day for the next 2 weeks.
Okay.
And on the day I was going to leave, I decided to stay an extra week.
Mm.
And that's when I asked her, where did you go to church?
Did you?
I said, where do you go to church? And I never ask anyone that because I'm not church.
Right.
And she said, well, I go to Marina Christian. And I said, well, I want to go with you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that shocked her because nobody she'd ever dated had asked to go to church. And I couldn't understand, really, why am I asking to go to church with this woman?
And let me tell you, it shocked her because she told me when she met you, she goes, this is the first time anyone's asked what church I go to. And you don't know why you asked.
You know, I wanted to know, there was something about her, and I wanted to know if any of it was spiritually based.
Okay. Right.
Or if I was kidding myself because I was infatuated.
Right.
You know, this is like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd already told people in Florida, I'm coming back, but it's going to be different.
Right.
So I stayed an extra week. We saw each other every day.
Mm-hmm.
I came back to Florida. We Skyped every day.
Mm-hmm.
I came back for New Year's. She came to Orlando for Valentine's Day.
Okay.
She came back for St. Patrick's weekend. And I had already asked her mother and her son for permission to marry her. And I proposed down on my knees while she was watching cartoons on TV. I had the ring on my pinky, and it was my mother's rings.
Oh, wow.
So she is... She's wearing Evelyn's rings.
And she's probably going to ask you, why did you tell him I'm watching cartoons?
And it's okay.
So anyway, but here's what's interesting, Dennis. It doesn't end there because somehow you went to a doctor.
Yeah.
And so you're engaged. Everything's going great.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm getting married.
Yeah.
True love of my life.
I was never going to get married again.
Yeah.
You know, this is my fourth marriage.
Yeah.
The other three were practice.
Right. Okay.
The other three were two very good people.
Right.
But I wasn't ready to be married.
Yeah.
And I proposed on St. Patrick's Day. And 6 weeks later, I found out I had cancer.
Now, I'm sure you didn't laugh like that when you found out.
No, I remember Dr. Naglapati was trying to tell me, and I'm looking at him, and I just said, I have cancer, don't I? And he said, yes. And tears just shot out of my eyes because all I could think was, what did I get this woman into?
Right.
So I told her, I said, look, this is a situation. We haven't known each other that long.
Right.
It's not like we were engaged for 2 years. We were engaged for like six weeks.
Right.
We knew each other for like maybe 5 months.
Right.
So I said, look, you know, this is going to be ugly. It's going to be difficult. It's going to, you know, it's not going to be like, you know, your dream come true.
There's no guarantees.
Of anything.
Yeah.
Of anything.
Right.
I said, so fly away, leave.
Yeah.
I came and talked to you about it.
Right.
And you said, no, she's going to have to, like, step up and find her destiny. That all sounded good. You know, I didn't really care. Yeah, okay. I could see my mother taking care of my stepdad and what it did to her.
Right.
And I was not going to put this woman in that position.
Right.
I wasn't going to do it. So I told her, I said, look, you don't need this.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
I said, you sure? She said, I'm not going anywhere. So at that point, seriously, at that point, everybody else in my life, children, sibling, you know, friends, they were all relegated to being tied for second place in my life because Sue Elise Odom at the time was going to be Sue Elise Neal.
Right.
And she was first. And she became my partner, and I became her partner.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, some other relationships have ended, and others have gotten stronger.
Mm.
I love my wife more than any words can say.
Well, it's interesting, too. We got together lunch about a month ago, and you guys were separated before she was with her mother getting surgery. And you were telling me, I have been with this woman 24/7. And it's the only relationship I've been with a woman 24/7.
That's right.
And I miss her.
I miss her.
So the relationship.
And she, we like each other. See, you know, love. The love is easy.
Yeah.
The love is easy.
Yeah.
I love you. Oh, I love you too. Right. Oh, I'm in love. Yeah, I'm in love too.
Yeah.
You know, that's so easy.
Right.
You know, when we talk about that greatest commandment.
Yeah.
You know, love one another. Right. That's it. So loving, to me, is easy.
Right.
Liking is difficult.
Okay.
I like Susan.
Right.
I like her quirky. I like her. I like the fact that she can talk my ear off.
Yeah.
And I'm right there with her. And when I'm not, she's still talking and she's good with it. We have similar senses of humor. She has embraced all of my friends. Right. I embraced all of her friends. And all of the ones on each end who weren't really friends right. have just gone to the wayside.
Right.
We have no ugly in our lives.
Right.
None.
Yeah.
We don't allow it. We don't yell. You know, I mean, this is like 3 years plus right. that we've been married, and I can't believe that we haven't gone at it at least once.
Yeah.
Because every relationship I had in the past
it's a healthy relationship.
It's very healthy.
And I had the privilege of doing the wedding.
Yes, you did. Yeah. Yes,
and
you
it
did.
Was such a fun wedding.
Yes, it was.
It really was fun.
Yes, it was.
One more subject I want to focus
okay.
on before we close it out is that you started attending church with Solise.
Yeah.
Okay. And Dennis and I have built this interesting and loving friendship with each other. And he's given me some incredible insights on what would you call it? White privilege?
Yeah.
And the one thing I've learned about white people trying to explain.
Yeah, so, white-splaining.
White-splaining. White-splaining.
Yep.
And so I think for me as a white person, if I just started being open and just listen, I think we talk too much.
You know, it's funny because the skit that was on Saturday Night Live, the night of the election, there was a line in there that one of Dave Chappelle's character said.
Dave Chappelle.
We know the whites.
Uh-huh.
Black people, we know the whites. Right. We study you guys.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of being oppressed and being the oppressor, the oppressor doesn't really have to pay that much attention.
Mm.
They just have to keep their foot on the neck of the people they're keeping down.
Mm.
The oppressed better be paying attention.
Right.
So I paid attention from the time I've had visits to South Carolina, nuns, my white classmates, working in corporate America, teaching school in New York, working at legal aid, working in the streets, all stuff before I was an actor,
right.
working in corporate America for Xerox, the New York Times, paying attention to the oppressor. And the game hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
And there is white privilege, and white people in general, not specific right. whites that I know, yeah. but white people in general. You know how they talk about, you know how them black people are, yeah. and they generalize? Mm. Well, I'm making this generalization.
Right.
White people in general like to, like, keep their heads in the dark because mm. they know we got this privilege here. We don't want to mess this mm. up.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
I'm not having it.
No.
I'm confronting everybody. I'm profiling everybody.
Yeah.
I'm like 68 years old. Mm. I ain't got time to shuck and jive.
Yeah. So the thing is, what I want to get to was you're religious. Because I've noticed that when you come to church, you love it. You enjoy it. And you're very complimentary.
But
there's an inconsistency.
Yes, there is a...
And which most people have an inconsistency.
Yeah, but this one is a very noticeable inconsistency, and it's very pointed.
Which pointed, and this is where I want to go to.
Okay.
I respect, you say, hey, I'm going to be at church Sunday, and I respect you tell me through a text message, I'm not going to go to church. So you kind of talked to me and said, I'm having this issue. I'm having this problem. What is that problem?
Okay.
With religion.
I believe in a God.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in a God the Father
mm-hmm.
or God the Mother.
Mm-hmm.
That's limiting things by my capacity as a human.
Right.
But I believe in a supreme being.
Right.
Okay. I believe in the love and teachings of Jesus Christ.
Correct. Okay.
I hesitate to call myself a Christian,
mm-hmm.
but I will adamantly and forcefully profess myself a Jesusite.
Okay.
I'm a Jesus kind of guy.
Right.
I believe that if you walk in the temple and the bankers are acting raggedy,
mm.
kick their ass.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that.
Yeah.
I believe in loving everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Greatest commandment, love one another.
Right.
If you do that, right. you don't have to be concerned with the other 10 that were,
yeah.
you know, given to Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Love one another. We can't seem to do that. Oh, yeah, and everybody can be a really good Christian during service,
right?
But then outside. So, Kevin, PK.
That's what they call me, PK.
I'm a spiritual person. I believe in being good for nothing.
Mm.
I don't believe that I need to get a reward of heaven to be good down here.
Mm.
My tithing is a little different. I give money to people in the streets, and I don't care if you get food or if you get high.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get what you need to get, and it'll get you through another day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very pragmatic. I don't believe in hope. I said that before.
Right.
Had a friend that used to say, hope is for suckers. Well, you know, I don't believe it's for suckers, but hope means that I'm not satisfied and that I can do better.
Right.
That's what it means. Mm-hmm. Or I can bend God's will.
Okay.
In one of the Bibles that I read, and I do read the Bible,
mm-hmm.
One of the translations in the Corinthians passage mm-hmm. that we read at our wedding,
mm-hmm.
the love passage, mm-hmm. says that we don't know enough about God to speak about God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That says it for me.
Mm-hmm.
That really does say it.
Right.
I practice being good for nothing,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also living my life out of control. Yeah. I don't run the show.
Right.
I do not run the show. I don't control anything.
Right.
And I tried to find out if I really could control things. I drank a bottle of prune juice once, and I couldn't control. Okay.
He did a facial expression, which I'm glad the facial expression came out instead of the words.
Yes.
Okay. But anyway, that's a perfect way to end the podcast.
You know I love you, right?
I know you love me, and you know I love you.
I know that.
You know that. And so, good for nothing.
And out of control.
And out of control.
That's it.
And so what I like about this church is we're not a cookie-cutter church.
No, you're not. I get to come to a church
yeah.
that is very diverse from head to toe. I love the message. I don't want to dilute it. So I come when I really feel impelled to come.
Right.
I don't ever want to be somewhere just to be there.
Okay.
I've come sometimes when Pastor Ruben was doing church. Mm-hmm. I've come when Pastor Marissa was doing church. And I've not come when they've done church, or when you've done church.
Absolutely.
Sometimes church for me, you know, I've been told, well, it's, you know, church is the fellowship. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, sometimes I don't want the fellowship. You know, I don't want to be around a bunch of people that are just as messed up as me.
Right.
And sometimes I do. That's why I went to AA for years and years and years and years, and I got what I needed to get, and then I applied it out here in the real world. Because I don't want to be around a bunch of recovering alcoholics saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. I got to take what I hear in church and apply it outside. Yeah. I've got to make it active. And I do that to the best of my ability.
No,
you know, I'm not everybody's cup of tea. And I'm good with that.
Yeah.
Because I figure if you're everybody's cup of tea, you're not doing something right. You know, if everybody likes you, you're not doing
something.
You
compromise
who
you are.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that, you know.
No.
And people that know me from when we were little, I'm blessed because I'm friends with people for 65 years. Mm-hmm. I'm friends with former fourth grade students that I taught back in 1969, 70, eighth grade students, people that I've worked with. You know, usually you leave places and you leave most of those relationships. I've been pretty blessed, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. And Dennis comes to 10:45 service very periodically. So you may see him, you may not see him. But anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you
so much, man. And you have a great marriage with Sue Lee. So one of these days I'm going to re-interview her about her story.
She's my heart.
She has a great life. So thank you for listening to the podcast. Remember, every day is a gift from God. Use it wisely. God bless you, and we'll see you next week. Have a great day.
Perfect, though.
Did you feel good about it?
Yep.